supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. New Jersey joins 15 other states and the District of Columbia in a lawsuit challenging President Donald Trump's decision to end the DACA program. Details from WHYY's Phil Gregory.
The program provides temporary protection from deportation for immigrants who were children when they came into the United States illegally with their parents. Governor Phil Murphy, a Democrat, says if the DACA program ends, it would prevent some of the best and brightest from living their dreams.
To deny every one of New Jersey's 22,000 dreamers the ability to become American citizens is to deny justice.
New Jersey Attorney General Gurbir Graywall says the litigation challenges what he considers unlawful federal efforts to violate the rights of hardworking immigrants and seeks to preserve protections so they can pursue the American dream.
We're making it absolutely clear today that we will use all of the tools of the Attorney General's office to protect the rights of dreamers to enjoy that American dream, and to ensure the safety and well-being of all New Jerseyans, regardless of their immigration status.
The comments came at a ceremony where Graywall administered the oath to one of the first DACA participants to become a lawyer in New Jersey. Mount Laurel resident Parthiv Patel says he and other dreamers are hoping to get a permanent fix so they can be legal citizens and remain in the U.S.
At times they might be timid, at times they might be shy to come out and speak about the situation. But once they realize that they aren't alone, that people are ready and able to stand up and support you, more and more will come out, and eventually we'll have this upswelling of support we need to pass it through Congress.
Governor Murphy says he's also planning to create a state office of immigrant protection and defense. At the State House, Phil Gregory, WHYY News.
Often lost amid the numbers debate around immigration and refugee status is the focus on those caught up in it. 13 is a lucky number for one husband, and decidedly unlucky for his wife, whose status in the overseas refugee camp where they met remains very much in limbo. Matt Katz reports on immigration, national security, and refugees for WNYC News, and focused on this Congolese couple in a report entitled Unsettled, a story from the global refugee crisis. Matt, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks very much, Dave.
To what extent was 13 lucky?
13 days before President Trump was elected, Andre Twendeli, a Congolese refugee, was able to fly into the U.S., land at JFK Airport, and move to Elizabeth, New Jersey, where he resettled and moved into an apartment with two other Congolese refugees. This was a big deal for Andre Twendeli. He spent 11 years in refugee camps in Africa after escaping violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
So not only did he defy the odds, less than 1% to be able to come to the United States, he was decidedly lucky to be alive.
Absolutely. He was a law student back at the Democratic Republic of Congo, and he led a protest against the president, still the president, President Joseph Kabila, who's something of an authoritarian there. He was arrested for the protest, taken to a prison, beaten, and then brought into the woods to be executed. But he had become friendly with one of the guards, and the guard decided to pretend to shoot him. So he watched his friends get shot in the head, firing squad killed, and then the guard pretended to shoot Andre. Andre played dead, and he waited until morning when the guards left. I spoke to him about this. He talked about how he checked to see if his friends were alive.
I tried to touch all of my friends there. They were dead, all of them.
He makes his way into the refugee camp, and he ends up having to stay as a refugee for 11 years. He had no contact with his family. He didn't know his parents died until he got to New Jersey 11 years later.
It's an amazing story of human triumph amid squalor, boredom, health problems, etc. It's also a love story.
Absolutely. You know, while he was living life, he fell in love. A woman walked into the camp. She was barefoot. She also had this unbelievably harrowing story of persecution in Congo. And after she was there for a few months, she met Andre. And, you know, as young men do, kind of fell in love at first sight, and they just started spending some time together as friends, and then it turned into something more, and she fell in love back with him, and they would date in the camp.
He had been their
what, 8 years when they first met.
Right.
And he was already embarked on the process to come, not necessarily to the United States, but to settle somewhere.
Yeah, exactly right. Officials from America, from the Department of Homeland Security, interviewed him in person. They agreed that he was a victim of political persecution and was not a security risk to live in this country. And they told him in October of 2016 that he was moving to America.
Let's go back to the numbers. Part of the pretext for turning off the spigot is the risk that terrorists could sneak in.
Right.
To what extent is that a legitimate concern?
I mean, the numbers don't indicate that it's a issue. The last time a refugee killed somebody in American soil in a terrorist attack was literally the 1970s. Nothing has happened. There have been no lethal terrorist attacks by refugees since. There's also an argument that they're a sap to the system financially. And it's true. Each refugee costs about $2,000 when they come into the country for resettlement costs. They're also eligible for Medicaid. If they work for a certain period of time, they're also eligible for unemployment. But studies show that after 20 years, they actually contribute more into the American system than they take out after they've been here for some time. They are vetted more than any other visitor into America. They are considered by advocates for immigrants to be model immigrants in that way, refugees are, because they've been checked so thoroughly and they are so thrilled, really, to be here considering where they came from.
A long time ago, Andre was a law student in Congo. In the court of law, he has filed an affidavit of relationship to try to get Lizette here. What does that mean, and how likely is that to wend its way through?
Well, Lizette had another opportunity to get here through a certain visa for relatives of refugees, but the Trump administration suspended that visa for a couple of months. A judge ordered it restarted, but it's unclear if it's being issued. So Andre had to file this affidavit of relationships, just certifying that Lizette is his wife, that she's a refugee, and that she should be vetted to come here. That paperwork has not really moved. The last we heard, there is just a huge backlog. The people who do refugee admissions have been reassigned to other matters within the Department of Homeland Security. And the numbers of refugees, the cap for how many refugees will be allowed into the country this year is 45,000. That's the lowest since the 1980 Refugee Act.
We, in our limited time, have presumably piqued the curiosity of listeners who I encourage to view the entire 40-minute report. We'll have a link to that at our website, whyy.org/news. Matt Katz, thanks so much for bringing this story to light and joining us at Newsworks tonight.
Thanks for having me in, David.
Matt Katz reports on immigration, national security, and refugees for WNYC News. One of Pennsylvania's longest-serving state senators is retiring, but Senator Stuart Greenleaf's son aims to keep the seat in the family. WHYY's Dana DeFilippo explains.
Stuart Greenleaf Jr. was just a baby when his father was first elected to the state Senate in 1979. On Monday, his dad, now 78, announced that he won't seek re-election. So Greenleaf Jr. says he'll run to represent residents of the 12th District, which covers parts of Bucks and Montgomery counties. Although father and son share the same name, and both are Republicans and attorneys, Greenleaf Jr. says voters should expect change if they elect him.
I have a lot of respect for what he's done in the Senate, but we do have our policy differences.
He says education funding and pension reform are his priorities, while his father, who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, is known for his work on criminal justice. A Democrat also has announced her intentions to run in the 12th District. Maria Collette is a nurse from Lower Gwynedd. She says affordable health care and education funding are her priorities. Dana DeFilippo, WHYY News.
It's been a remarkable 24 hours in the case of sexual harassment allegations against Delaware County Congressman Pat Meehan. Meehan acknowledges that he approved a taxpayer-funded payment to a young woman on his staff last year who filed a complaint against him. And Meehan is now seeking to convince the public that he's done nothing wrong by giving interviews to reporters, including our own Dave Davies, who joins me now. Dave, starting off, what did the woman accuse the congressman of doing?
Well, her complaint, which was filed last year, accused Congressman Meehan of romantic overtures in a conversation and a handwritten letter. And then she said he became hostile when she didn't reciprocate his affections. There was lawyers were brought on. There were negotiations, a payment, and a confidentiality agreement to settle the matter.
Interesting strategy. The congressman has taken to granting interviews to tell his side of the story. And you spoke to him yesterday. What did he have to say?
Dave, I have to tell you, this may be the most awkward interview I've ever done. He said he had deep affection for this woman, but insisted that he never made a romantic overture. I've posted the entire conversation on my blog at whyy.org because I think it's interesting to hear his comments in their full context. But just to give you a bit of a sense of how he explained things, let's listen to this segment.
I've been upfront with the idea that while we worked together, there was a growing affection that I wanted to make sure that I struggled with, to make sure that I would never cross that line. I believe that I was invited to be able to communicate about that.
Right. So he says he had these feelings of affection. The word soulmate was used in some interviews. He said they were more like kindred spirits. And he says she welcomed this kind of conversation, and he insists that he always made it clear he was happily married and had no interest in a physical relationship. That's thus his reference to not crossing the line. He also, Dave, provided copies of the handwritten letter that he sent to her, and you can see that on WHYY.org. He also provided some text messages. As a whole, they show a friendly, if not romantic, relationship between the two. He did admit to me when in the conversation that it was emotionally difficult for him when this woman entered into a serious relationship with another man.
Now, Dave, if he thinks he didn't do anything wrong, how does he explain her filing a sexual harassment complaint?
Well, exactly. And I asked him that question, and he didn't have much of an answer. He said he was extremely disappointed. You know, we're really not hearing the whole story here, obviously. The complainant in this case is protecting her privacy. I've spoken to her attorney. She says she is not going to answer Mr. Meehan's charges, but she will cooperate with a House Ethics Committee investigation, which is underway.
Dave, what's the reaction from voters in his district?
Well, we sent Avi Wolfman-Aaron out to the heart of the district in media today, and here's what he got from a couple of folks.
I was honestly shocked. Don't know why I was shocked, because a politician's a politician, but I was shocked.
I am opposed to him continuing in Congress. I feel that he needs to release himself from this office and pay the consequences.
That was Joan Smith and Bridget Hertler, who were on the streets of Media, Pennsylvania today. The interesting thing is that 3 out of every 4 people Avi spoke to were not even aware of these allegations, so it's going to take a while to sink in.
Were Meehan's colleagues and Republican leaders similarly shocked?
This is interesting. You know, most of them aren't saying very much. Brian Fitzpatrick, the congressman in Bucks County, issued a statement in which he said he believes that there should be a thorough investigation and that Congressman Meehan should repay taxpayers the money paid to settle the matter. What I'm hearing privately is that leaders don't think that he is going to be able to readily weather this storm, because the fact is there was a complaint, there was a settlement, it involved money and a confidentiality agreement negotiated by lawyers, and whatever he says, it's very hard to get around that. This is how Chris Borick of Muhlenberg College put it.
There's not a lot of precedent I see for individuals in his situation being able to make an argument all the way to the point that voters might give you a pass.
So he'll make his case, and we'll see. There is, of course, one other scenario here, Dave. You know, the state Supreme Court on Monday found the Pennsylvania congressional districts unconstitutionally gerrymandered and ordered the legislature to redraw them. One could imagine a scenario in which Republicans in the legislature say, well, we need to have a more Democratic-friendly district. How about we make that Mr. Meehan, since he's kind of a wounded member of the herd anyway, and preserve other Republican incumbents? I don't know if that's going to happen, but I do know that Republican leaders are at least discussing that possibility.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies on Newsworks Tonight. A Philadelphia theater company is premiering a play this week dealing with sexual assault on a college campus. It's unusual because the entire cast consists of women, as well as gender nonconforming actors. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that it's also unusual because it's a comedy.
Playwright M.J. Kaufman does not think sexual assault is funny. Rather, finds comedy in places where people don't have the language to accurately describe what they're going through.
Our culture right now is trying to redefine language, and that's funny, you know, like when people don't have the words to talk about sexual assault and they say things like rapist, I mean perpetrator, I mean person who perpetrated. That's real, and it's a complicated reality, and we laugh at it.
You know how many students the Environmental Action Group has? Or the Women's History Month Coalition?
The play, called Sensitive Guys, is set in a fictional college where two groups of students, a men's group and a woman's group, are trying to end all sexual harassment and violence on campus in 5 years. In this scene being rehearsed, members of the women's group argue with each other about how much levity to put in a presentation they must make for prospective students. If they don't, the college might rescind their group status.
No, what we do isn't glamorous. It's not for everyone. We're not just like a resume booster for wannabe nonprofit executives. Well, we want people to actually show up.
There are no men performing in this play. All parts are played by females or actors who don't identify with either gender. Kaufman, too, is not gender-conforming, preferring to be referred to as they, as in, they started writing this play 2 years ago, before the Me Too movement put sexual assault in the news headlines nearly every day.
We kept coming back to the text and feeling differently because of the world. Like, we felt different levels of hopeful or not hopeful or raw or devastated and needed it to end on a different note. And so that's sort of the big question, too, is, like, audiences coming to see it now are bringing with them the news cycle that is triggering and complicated.
That we includes director Evren Ochkin, who is drawn to scripts that make audiences cry when they should be laughing and laugh when they should be crying. He says Kaufman's play presents a group of characters wading through a murky sexual minefield in an educational institution that provides no clear assistance.
We are used to the kind of survivor stories or sexual assault stories that has been fed to us through, you know, mainstream media that can be quite dehumanizing or sort of one-dimensional. And what MJ has done, which I think is beautiful, is that these people are not one-dimensional. They're funny, they hurt, they laugh, they cry, they support each other, but they don't baby each other.
Sensitive Guys opens Thursday for a 3-week run at the Drake Theater. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
A bipartisan group of legislators from our region is up in arms over the Interior Department's plan to open up waters off the East Coast for oil and gas drilling. WHYY's Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo reports that those lawmakers are moving more toward legal challenges rather than legislation.
Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke is coming under fire from lawmakers up and down the East Coast who oppose his plan to allow oil and gas drilling in the Atlantic Ocean. But the anger turned to outrage when Florida was given a waiver that blocks drilling off the state's shores.
Yeah, great for Florida, but, you know, what about New Jersey? So we're chopped liver once again.
That's South Jersey Republican Congressman Frank Lobiondo. He and most other Republicans from the East Coast oppose the effort, mostly because they view it as bad for tourism and fishing.
A lot of the reasons it's bad for Florida, it's bad for us. So if it is bad for Florida and they can get an exemption, why can't states that are so adamantly opposed to it continue to have the exemption?
Lobiondo is retiring after this year, but he says he's prepared to fight the Trump administration tooth and nail while still in office.
Well, we're going to ramp up our efforts. I'm asking for one of the hearings to be in Cape May County so there can be direct testimony about the potential damage that something like that would cause. And we'll have to work through the system that Florida didn't have to.
Zinke reversed course for Florida after meeting with the state's Republican Governor Rick Scott, who is expected to run for Senate later this year. New Jersey Democratic Senator Bob Menendez says that doesn't pass the political smell test.
If it's just because the state asks, well, New Jersey's asking. And unless you give it to New Jersey and any other state who's asked for the exemption, then it's purely political on the basis of Governor Scott asking. And I certainly don't believe that we run policy by blue or red states.
Menendez says a bipartisan group of lawmakers and interested parties are also planning to fight the proposal in court.
We will challenge things that President Obama permanently took off under the Outer Continental Shelf Act, and we will use every legal means, and we have a new governor who's fully on board with us.
But a few Republicans from coastal states are eager for coastal drilling. Virginia Congressman Morgan Griffith represents the coalfields in his state. He says coastal state lawmakers would be foolish to try to block drilling.
I've always been for it. We believe we have a big pool of natural gas out there. We need to get out there and explore. Everybody worries about oil, but the real riches are in natural gas.
Congressman Andy Harris is a Republican who represents Maryland's eastern shore, which includes the Chesapeake Bay and Ocean City. Harris says he's open to drilling under the right circumstances.
Yeah, first of all, I mean, it can't be within sight of shoreline. I mean, I feel the same way with the wind projects. But if it can be done further offshore and they can convince me it's done safely and the communities that would be affected agree to it, I'm not an opponent.
But Harris denies the administration played politics with Florida's exemption.
Look, that's consistent with my position is that the neighboring community, in that case it's the state of Florida, has to agree to it. If they don't agree to it, then the federal government shouldn't force it on them. But again, that's not my position. It's whatever the community's position is.
But most Republicans from our region say there's no need to put the tourism industry at risk from a spill, especially because the oil and gas industry is still going strong onshore. Here's Republican Ryan Costello, who represents parts of several counties west of Philadelphia.
Even from just the most purely practical sense and not even dealing with any sort of environmental considerations, we don't need it.
Costello says even without coastal drilling, the U.S. energy industry will still continue to be dominant for the foreseeable future.
I mean, you're going to continue to see more natural gas. It's proven itself to be resilient.
The proposal from the Trump administration is a draft. There was already a hearing in Delaware and one scheduled next month in New Jersey. The public comment period officially ends in March. For WHYY News, Matt Laszlo in Washington.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.